I'm longtime journalist and brand new podcaster Meg Heckman, and this is Radio Free Dystopia, a podcast about what we learn when dystopian fiction and current events start to look the same. I'm here with my co-host, Toby Ball, a writer of dystopian novels and a panelist on the hit podcast Crime Writers On. How are you, Toby?
I am ready for summer.
Yeah, me too. And actually, speaking of summer, we are planning an episode completely about young adult dystopian novels, and we are still looking for recommendations. I'll mention this again at the end of the show, but if you, or even better yet, your kids have a suggestion for a book with a dystopian theme that's appropriate for teens or tweens, we would love to hear from you. You can send us an email at radiofreedystopia@gmail.com. Voice memos are even better. Or you can get us on Twitter. We're at RF Dystopia. So tell us about your young adult dystopian reads. So our structure today is a little different because we're talking about a pretty big topic. It's the potentially dystopian relationship between human beings and technology. And it really is a huge topic. And when Toby and I were trying to wrap our heads around the fictional and real life parallels, we decided the easiest way to do that would be for each of us to talk to an expert. So Toby talked to a good friend of his about a really cool fictional example of a technocratic dystopia. And then I talked to an expert on civil liberties and emerging technologies. So we're going to play both of those interviews and talk about them in a minute. But first, I want to share a real whopper of a headline about intrusive technology.
Time for another fact-filled edition of The News from Dystopia.
So this story is a few months old, but it's so weird that I just really needed to share it. Burger King created a TV ad back in April that was designed to trigger Amazon's Alexa, that digital assistant that's in all those Echoes that everybody seems to have now. The ad triggered Alexa to read the ingredients in a Whopper. It was kind of clever. It was an interesting interplay between legacy and emerging technology, but it also caused a lot of problems, particularly after internet pranksters realized that Alexa was reading the Whopper's ingredients from a Wikipedia page. And so these pranksters went in and they actually changed the ingredients, as one can on Wikipedia. So Alexa would read that the Whopper contained things like toenail clippings and rodents. According to media reports, and this was pretty widely covered back in April, Google shut the whole thing down in a matter of hours, and they changed something with Alexa so she would no longer be triggered to read ingredients by this ad. It's such an interesting example of how even a fairly simple and, one would argue, innocent use of an emerging technology can really take on a life of its own.
This has been The News from Dystopia. Until next time, stay hopeful.
So, Toby, do you want to start by telling us a little bit about who you talked to and what you talked about?
Sure. So I talked to my friend Julian Gross, who I've actually known since I was born. He's a lawyer out in San Francisco. We both read a book called This Perfect Day by Ira Levin. And I won't go a whole lot into it because we talk about it in the conversation. But it is a sort of futuristic dystopian book that revolves around this very 70s idea that if you have a big enough computer that kind of gets all the possible inputs from everybody, that it will come out with this plan that's the best for everybody. And this futuristic society is kind of based on this idea. Hi, Julian.
Hey, Tobe. How's it going?
It is going pretty good. How about you?
Good. Excited to be here on Radio Free Dystopia.
Julian is a public interest lawyer in San Francisco. He's also an amateur musician and a voracious reader. And I can't tell you the number of hours that we have spent talking about books, things like that. So I'm psyched that he's here today. To talk about, as at least as a starting point, This Perfect Day by Ira Levin. If you don't know Ira Levin, he is one of our great thriller writers whose books include Rosemary's Baby, The Boys from Brazil, and The Stepford Wives. This Perfect Day is also a thriller, but it's kind of a departure for him in that it is not set in sort of current times. It is at some point in the future. Most of his thrillers take part in our society, and they've got sort of a twist and an unusual kind of take on certain aspects of our society. For this book, he creates a futuristic society in which he has this hero sort of undergo his adventure. So to kind of start this off, Julian, could you...
Wait, can we before we jump too deep into This Perfect Day, can we just pour one out for a second for Ira Levin, one of the sort of great unheralded pop culture thriller writers of the last 50 years, who, you know, I think for older listeners may remember sort of what a big deal in pop culture like Rosemary's Baby and The Stepford Wives and Boys from Brazil were in the late 60s, early 70s. And I find that these books really hold up if you go back and read them. They're really, each one of them is like an intricate, perfectly constructed puzzle box where each scene sort of is another piece in the puzzle and moves you a little more towards the big twist, the big reveal, a terrific climax, sharply drawn characters. They really hold up and you kind of never hear about them anymore.
Right, that's a good point. And that, you know, he's one of those guys, and I think Philip K. Dick is the other obvious one, whose books just make great movies.
Anyway, the books are tight. They're fun sort of beach reads, but like I say, they really hold up. And I'm really psyched to talk about This Perfect Day, which a close friend of mine in college gave to me and read. And I've read it probably three or four times over the decades since then and always really enjoyed it. It's so sharply written. And as we'll get into today, it's really interesting on the technological side. And I can't believe no one's made a movie of it. It seems like a perfect movie.
So can you give a brief rundown on sort of this future society that we get plopped down into?
Yeah, so it starts off with the protagonist, we'll just call him Lee. That's a sort of shortened version of his name. They actually, in this society, instead of names, they have what they call namebers, where your name is a combination of one of four accepted names and a number. So that's an initial kind of creepy detail you get right from the get-go. And it sort of starts off with some of his earliest memories as a kid, where on day, the bracelet that every citizen has to wear at all times, as kids grow, they get another link in their bracelet, so the bracelet gets a little bigger. So instead of a birthday, they have a link day, and that's sort of one of his earliest memories, is getting another link in his chain on his bracelet. And you find out pretty quick that in this society, it's sort of your classic, very tightly controlled dystopian future society where everybody's constantly monitored. You have to sort of put your bracelet up to the scanner each time you go anywhere in or out of a building or along the streets. You have to sort of be letting the system know where you're going. And really quickly, you start to get, through the eyes of this kid, an understanding of sort of just how creepy and overwhelming this society is, where you're told where you can go, you're told who you can be with, you're assigned the job, you're sent around the world to wherever the system says you should go. And the system starts coming into focus. And as far as the citizens of the society know, it's called UNI. It's a unified computer system that controls everything and makes sure that nobody is sick and there's no crime and everybody's in perfect safety. And UNI knows best is kind of the notion. And basically all the citizens seem to have subsumed their free will completely to this big computer that's gonna keep them all safe and give them all the jobs and the life choices that will make for a best functioning society.
Yeah, so this is kind of, the copyright's 1970. So this was written at a time when, you know, I think there was this idea that computers could, by being clearer thinkers and super smart, sort of make better decisions than humans could. Len Dayton wrote a book called The $1 Billion Brain, and sort of the gist of the book was that there was this supercomputer that was, you could feed it information and that it would run I think it was the Soviet spy system better than the Western spy system. So the world was hanging in the balance. It's interesting now to take to when reading it, that some of the stuff in This Perfect Day is pretty prescient, I think. And then other other things seem like the classic, what people 50 years ago thought the future was going to be like, and how they kind of got it wrong.
Right. It's interesting because there is that sort of attractive human need that you see in psychology, you know, to a greater or lesser degree in probably everybody, but certainly to a greater or lesser degree in cultures, of the attractiveness of wanting to sort of give up your free will and accept the notion that somebody else knows better and can figure it out for you. And you're relieved from tough decisions that could go wrong, from the pressure of those things. And, you know, if results can be delivered and you can be kept safe, then that's great. And, you know, I feel like I saw this a little bit with my father, who was a very independent thinker, very brilliant guy, didn't really subsume his opinion to anybody else in his life at any point, until he got a bad medical diagnosis. And then he didn't want to be the active patient who read all the studies and figured everything out. He wanted to figure out who the best doctor was and do whatever that person said. And that was part of sort of a coping mechanism for him. And it was just comforting in a very stressful time to have this, to know that, so have this idea and just accept an idea that somebody else knows better than you do. And thus, you know, it's going to be okay. That's behind whatever attractiveness there is, I think, in a lot of authoritarian cultures and some of these dystopian futures. So, you know, in This Perfect Day, you hear about this or you read about this culture. And yeah, it seems really creepy, and it's supposed to, and that's one of the best things about the book is how subtly but clearly creepy everything is in this society. But also, it doesn't seem completely implausible.
It's interesting that you're talking about your father, in that when you're faced with something that you don't have much personal knowledge about, being able to put your trust in someone who, you know, in that case, really does, but at least purportedly does, at least as much as far as you know, you know, I mean, that kind of sounds like the way like North Korea just is, in that if you keep people in, you know, relative ignorance about the world around them, you know, it's easy to keep authority because there's no contradictory information getting through to you. And that's kind of, and that's sort of what starts off. And there's going to be some spoilers in this, and I guess we'll try and alert you before.
I guess
some of
anyone who's worried too much about spoilers on a book that came out 50 years ago.
Yeah,
like it is an awesome book, and there are some terrific plot twists in there. So if you want to just go read it based on our great recommendation, then come back to this podcast. That would be great. But I think we do to have a full discussion of how
right.
Of this book. We need to get some of these twists out on the table.
So I think one of sort of the first point at which Lee sort of figures out that there's more to the world than what he knows. It's kind of complicated because there's more than just this computer's telling you what to do. That you also go in and have these like weekly injections, which seem right. to be a combination of sort of antibiotics, antidepressants, birth control, but also sort of a libido suppressor. So they, you know, like Sunday night is love night. And when they start, Lee starts getting weaned off his doses, he's like shocked to realize that he, you know, he feels like having sex more than once a week. But the first time he starts to sort of suspect that there's more to what's going on in the world than what he sort of sees through Uni the computer is when he meets up with this sort of underground faction that meets in this museum. And in the museum, he discovers that, you know, there are places that Uni has kind of covered up, you know, that in the maps that people know about, there are certain islands that have been sort of whitewashed. And this is sort of what starts to spark his interest in that maybe living under control of this computer isn't the only possible way to live.
Right. Figuring out that there actually are parts of the world that Uni doesn't control. And, you know, to me, this was one of the sort of most, I mean, this is the main plot driver for probably the first half or two thirds of the book, is him sort of slowly through the fog of the drugs that Uni puts into his system and, you know, the cultural stimulation around him, he starts to sort of connect with people in this secret way that are interested in living a fuller life. That sort of psychological awakening was really terrific and almost sort of inspiring. I do know some people who've read this book and thought of it as, or this early section of the book that we're talking about, as an analogy, not just thinking about dystopian societies in general, but thinking about our society and like how much of our society in our daily life is sort of arranged around the notion that we have this shared set of rules that keeps us all safe. And if you don't question them, you can just go along and have this safe, easy life. And, you know, you could take the analogy as far as you want with these injections of substances that sort of dull our senses and make us not question things and make us content. And by far the path of least resistance is to conform. But then, you know, people start to get these little glimmers of like, God, is there more to it than going on in your life? As we're living it right now. And, you know, that's part of the attraction in our world of being able to go to other cultures and meet other people and do things differently. But, you know, there's so much momentum in terms of society for conformity. And I did have a friend who read this and was like, it just made me think about, like, what you're losing when you don't question the assumptions of the society around you.
Yeah, I don't know how much of a, like, whether Ira Levin was, like, a socialist or whatever, but there's definitely like an association of Uni as sort of like a godlike presence. And then
right.
Like people are literally, you know, getting injections. So like the sort of opiate of the masses is like a literal thing. It's this absolute faith, unquestioning. There are these interactions that he has, that Lee has when he starts to question, you know, his life, and he kind of brings he kind of hints at things, and people are just like, what are you talking about? You also have these sort of, you know, kind of advisors, I guess, who everyone's assigned to one, and they come and sit down and talk to you, and it's actually a very sort of, if it's creepy, it's that it's creepy in sort of this, like, super affirmative way that, right. Like, anything you do isn't really your fault. It's like that you're sick. You know, even when he gets kind of violent and is like trying to break free and actually hurts somebody, like the person, I guess he hurts his advisor, if I'm remembering this right. And he's like, oh, you know, I feel so badly that you're so sick that you did something like this. So there's like, there's no real blame. It's just, we'll just have to give you a bigger dose. You know, your dose was wrong. You got to get blissed right. out a little bit more.
We all failed because you didn't, right. You had this crazy sick reaction of not wanting to go along with the program.
Yeah, so it's a pretty, you know, it's a pretty interesting and I think kind of insightful look at the way society works and how kind of religion is in some ways tied into sort of how we behave and are in some ways docile, I guess, in the face of things that we perhaps should be questioning.
So one of the things I was thinking about when you invited me to be on RFD was sort of how technology is portrayed and how sort of essential it is to the idea of dystopian fiction, like how much of it is a defining part of it. And it does seem really central to it, right? Because, I mean, when I remember in your first episode, you guys were sort of talking about the difference between dystopian fiction and this sort of the really well-established genre of post-apocalyptic fiction. You know, there's a lot in common there, right? It's a different society. It's, you know, generally portrayed as like a horrible society. You know, people trying to make their way and make a culture in this different setting. But it seems like the advancement or lack thereof of technology, to me, is the big difference between those two genres, right? If you're in a dystopian world, the technology is either where it is right now or advanced farther in the future. But the defining thing about the post-apocalyptic world is that the technology has been sort of wiped away, and you're back to hunting and gathering and tribal warfare and, you know, living off the grid and all these things.
Right.
Does that sound right? Or
yeah, I think the combination of sort of technology and then also the stable state, I guess, you know, generally totalitarian government. I think those are sort of the two main factors, I guess.
Right.
I'm sure people could take issue with that.
You know, so sometimes it's like, I feel like some of the dystopian fiction is a world where, like, the machines are sort of slowly creeping up on your life, right? So that's where, you know, without any necessarily bad intent, so that's where I think a lot of the dystopian future stuff gets the closest to our current technological world and was very present in This Perfect Day and in other things like Minority Report, where you've got technology tracking your every move. So basically, like, everyone in This Perfect Day is like wearing these bracelets and you have to scan the bracelet for, you know, the computer to know where you're going. But actually right now in our world, we're all carrying cell phones around, right? And the computers know where we're going. There's a record of it, right? And if, I don't know if you guys remember, you remember a few years ago, there was a hack that someone found with Apple products where you could see the log of the movements of people who had iPhones. So you could see like all your family members' movements, even though they hadn't enabled a tracking feature of any kind. And
those bastards.
Right. So, but it's like, we are sort of going along with this giant experiment that, you know, if you looked at in isolation and wasn't incremental, and certainly if it was imposed by someone else, would be, you know, fantastically objectionable. But, you know, we're sort of going along incrementally, like letting technology track all our communications and all our movements and keep a permanent record of those things. And it's just getting more so with the facial recognition that's everywhere and is in, you know, all the photos that are posted on Facebook now, you know, there's.
Yeah. Yeah. It's interesting when you were talking about that. And I was also thinking about, I think there's a murder. I haven't looked too much into this, but I think there's a murder case. And part of the defense is that this guy was wearing his Fitbit and because he had that on, they were able to show where he'd been at various times when this murder was supposedly being committed. I'm probably getting this totally wrong, but it had something to do with Fitbit and GPS location.
Well, that, I mean, whether it's right or wrong, that it's a perfect point because, so, you know, in my lawyering, like, you know, when you're in law school, you read all these cases about the Fourth Amendment, about the government's right to conduct searches and when it's reasonable and when it's not reasonable. You know, the Fourth Amendment obviously was written a few hundred years ago, didn't anticipate this time when all this record of all our activities and communications and movement was available to law enforcement and how law enforcement should use those things. And the defense, the proponents of law enforcement access and, you know, oversight at all times, always come back to the Fitbit scenario, we can call it now since you raised that, which is, if you've got nothing to hide, what is your objection to having us be able to review your behavior? So that's sort of like, you think it's sort of like a thing that's wired into Americans in their DNA, is like freedom from the government, intrusive oversight. But actually, anytime that it really becomes a question of like, should the government be able to look at the security cameras in the hallway to check for a drug activity or whatever? Everyone's like, sure, if it's about catching criminals, we'll do it. I've got nothing to hide.
Well, Toby, I was thinking about getting a Fitbit, but after listening to that conversation, no.
Well, if you got a phone, it's all the same.
I know. I actually, you know, as I was listening to you and Julian talk, I was thinking about a couple things. One, I really want to grab this book and make it one of my summer reads. But the other thing I did was I kind of did a mental rundown of everything I do by choice that provides somebody with information about where I am and what I'm into. And, you know, my iPhone has a ton of apps on it, and I am almost never without my phone. I take it running with me. I use it to track my steps during the day. I use it to order groceries. I mean, Amazon knows my soul. And so, I mean, there are a number of apps that know everything that I'm into. And this is information that I am giving up willingly because it makes my life easier. And it occurred to me that if this is all of the information that I'm willing to give up, what am I giving up, or what are we giving up unwillingly or unknowingly? And that's what made me reach out to a really smart expert on this subject. Her name is Lisa Graves, and Lisa is the executive director of the Center for Media and Democracy, which is based in Wisconsin. And according to Lisa's bio, she served as a senior advisor in all three branches of the federal government and worked as a leading strategist on civil liberties advocacy in the area of national security. She's also an adjunct law professor, and that's probably why she did such an amazing job of explaining some really complicated stuff to me in our conversation.
You've been working in the area of civil liberties for a long time now, and I'm wondering how emerging technology is changing the types of issues that you and people like you have to engage with on a daily basis.
Well, sure. My job has changed over time. I was previously the senior legislative strategist for the ACLU on national security issues, and then the deputy director of the Center for National Security Studies, and then I became the leader of the Center for Media and Democracy. And so my work has broadened its focus, and that has sort of broadened my awareness of the variety of technology issues that affect the American people in terms of our democracy, basically. And so while I still keep a close eye on a lot of the things that are going on in Washington in terms of the discussions on the Hill about the National Security Agency and the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act and the authorities of the FBI and the like, I also look at issues beyond those agencies in terms of corporate control and access to information about people from the vantage point of, you know, how does this affect our democracy and how does this affect people's liberties? And so I think that one of the things that has stayed with me over this decade, more than a decade now, that I have been looking at these issues more closely is that Frank Church, who was a senator from Idaho, who led a committee investigating the powers of the intelligence agencies in the late 1970s, mid to late 1970s, he was the leader of that Church committee. He expressed at that time a grave concern about the types of powers that the National Security Agency had at that time, and worry about whether if those powers, those weapons of surveillance were turned inward on the American people versus focused outward on foreign nations like the Soviet Union then, now Russia, what would happen to our liberty, that there would be very little protection for individual liberty. And I think that his fear in that way has come true in spades, in the sense that the technology of the mid-1970s has been utterly dwarfed by the technological advances we've seen and the ability of the government and of corporations to capture a massive amount of quantity about people, who their friends are, what they care about, what they're worried about in terms of Google searches, for example, what they purchase, where they go. And so we are, I'm not sure we're at peak surveillance, but we certainly are at a peak in surveillance thus far in human history. And that surveillance is both happening through the activities of our government as well as foreign governments, in addition to the massive amount of surveillance in the internet age conducted by foreign firms and U.S. firms, predominantly U.S. mega corporations, for profit, profiting from access to information about us and combining that information to advance political agendas, to advance commercial agendas, and more.
Just for the average technology user who cares about privacy but doesn't want to go back to pen and paper and a completely analog life, what are a handful of kind of concrete issues that they can focus on?
Well, you know, that is a great question. There are so many different ways in which our privacy has been diminished, mm-hmm. and is invaded on a daily, hourly, or minute-by-minute basis. It can be a bit overwhelming. You know, I think that there are steps that people can take, but I don't know how effective any of them are in the grand scheme of things, given the pervasiveness of this surveillance regime that has taken hold. I also am concerned that, and I wrote about this in a Law Review article a couple of years back, I'm concerned that the Fourth Amendment, which focuses on warrants, but also has a reasonableness test in it, basically has set the stage for an ever devolution, in essence, of our privacy rights. Because under the Fourth Amendment, there's a category of activities in which you must have a warrant. The government must have a warrant to search your home, for example. However, there is now an increasingly wide array of activity, digital communications that can be seized without a traditional warrant, meaning a warrant naming you as a target or someone you know as the target. And on an individualized basis, there's much more mass surveillance going on. And that presents tremendous challenges in terms of protecting people's civil liberties in this digital age. There are some things people can do to try to mitigate that to some extent. People can use software that encrypts their email communications. Some of that point-to-point encryption has become easier to use with off-the-shelf products like Virtru and other encryption technologies that make it easier for people to communicate with one another through an encrypted means. There's obviously encryption already of purchases in terms of credit card data, but that sort of encryption has been no real protection against the types of data breaches that we've seen from major corporations. People can also use other ways to communicate by phone if they want to protect their business communications or more, things like Signal, which is a way to communicate on an encrypted basis digitally by phone. People can try to deploy some of the tools that companies like Facebook provide, for example, in terms of your restrictions on who can see your posts, limiting it to friends versus everybody, that sort of thing. But at the end of the day, Facebook has all of that content. And while Facebook has stated that it would protect people from, in essence, lawless government searches of their posts, Facebook, along with the other providers of such technology, as well as phone services, internet services, receive an enormous number of requests per year from law enforcement at the federal, state, and local level for access to that information. And the companies, each of the companies uses a different approach to how they respond to those requests and whether they even tell their customers ever that their communications have been seized by law enforcement. But that's only one part of the equation. The other part of the equation is how much of that data about you, about your beliefs, about your ideas, your political positions and the like have been accessed by other corporations for private gain or for political gain. For example, Cambridge Analytica, which is a firm that Steve Bannon, the notorious White House advisor, has a stake in, along with a billionaire family, the Mercers, is reported to have used intelligence gathered from Facebook postings in order to micro-target people with what I believe to be deceptive ads in the last political campaign, ads that escaped political scrutiny by the media for the most part.
Why do you think they escaped scrutiny? Is it because they were so micro-targeted or just because there was so much going on during the last election cycle?
Well, there's certainly a lot going on, but if you think about how this process works, and Trump wasn't the first candidate to use it, but I think that certainly the claims of Cambridge Analytica indicate a virtually unprecedented unification of certain types of data about specific individuals, along with psychological profiling of people to figure out buttons to push with them, combined with micro-targeted ads. And what that means in reality is, for example, they've touted an ad that they ran against Hillary Clinton that was targeted at Cuban Americans in Miami. If you're not that target audience, you don't see that ad. If you're not a reporter who's in that target audience on Facebook at the time those ads are being pushed out, you don't see those ads. And the people who receive those ads there's no sort of counter ad saying that ad is ridiculous, that ad is false, it's fake, it's distorted. There's no one who can know who the person is or the group is that's identified as sponsoring that ad. You have to see the ad in order to be able to respond to it, to uncloak who claims to have produced it, in order to uncloak or debunk any of the misleading claims or false statements made in such an ad. And so that's that expansion is a massive, a new front that challenges transparency rules that are built on mass media. Our rules for elections in terms of the disclosure of ads and who is the sponsor of an ad is built in part on mass media, but we're rapidly entering an era of micro-targeting.
Wow. You know, when I was still working in the newsroom full time, I remember how hard it was just to keep track of really traditional television and mail and radio advertising, no matter how diligent we were to fact check that. Mm-hmm. And no matter how many hours we poured into that, it just felt like there was never enough time.
Yeah, I think that's one of that's the new frontier. And there's no way this Congress and this president are going to address that. There's no way we're going to get any regulatory reform in this near term. And meanwhile, we're going to have, you know, a midterm election, another presidential election, likely before there's any willingness or even possibility of having any reforms to address this dramatic shift in the way political ads are going to be run. I would be surprised if a number of these micro-targeting ads basically don't outnumber, outreach, you know, aren't much more widely distributed, in essence, you know, micro-targeting on a sort of wide basis across the country and races at every level. I would be surprised if it doesn't in the near term ultimately dwarf television spending, because why would you spend the money on mass marketed ads when you could spend pennies on the dollar for micro-targeted ads and really hit your audience and ply them with what I believe is a substantial amount of disinformation by these political campaigns or by the C4, the nonprofits that are basically backstopping them through these dark money operations. And so I think it really undermines the integrity of our elections to have that sort of undisclosed activity really running rampant. It's going to get worse.
So that's one thing that's out there. What are some other kind of emerging areas of concern?
Well, there's certainly been some conversations on the Hill about what's known as the 702 authorities under the FISA Amendments Act, which was a law that was passed at the end of the Bush administration, but it was implemented by the Obama administration. Those were substantial changes to the Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act. Prior to those changes, the statutory law required there to be an individual warrant to engage in electronic surveillance of certain types of communications, and it's sort of a complicated area, but the heart of it was that if the communications were purely domestic communications within the United States, they couldn't be seized by the national intelligence agencies. There were a set of protections, even to protect against the agencies saying that they had to do testing, quote, testing domestically that might collect those communications. And then after September 11th and measures pushed secretly by the Bush administration, there was a massive expansion of the collection and the acquisition, in essence. Collection is a term of art that they use, but acquisition of communications of Americans, including some substantial amount of purely domestic communications, and that includes data as well as content. Now, they claimed that there was much more focus on the international, purely international communications, meaning foreign to foreign communications. Then there's international communications involving Americans, and then there's purely domestic communications. And those were there were some technological differences in the way those were described in the statute. Mm-hmm. But the core of that was that there was a zone that basically was subject to greater protection, and that was purely domestic communications. But when the FISA Amendments Act was passed at the behest of the telecom companies, I think trying to escape financial liability for their role in aiding this mass surveillance, pushed by the Director of National Intelligence, Admiral McConnell, who was chosen by George W. Bush and Dick Cheney, that bill changed the rules to basically allow what they described in various ways as basket warrants or program warrants that would allow a program of surveillance to be approved. And that, quote, program of surveillance was by definition mass surveillance. And previously a protection under the old regime, which was that the government could not obtain purely domestic communications if it knew the people were in the United States, that shield became a sword. So now if they're requiring digital communications happening at the speed of light, the government's position has in essence been that it doesn't know where anyone is at all times. And so it doesn't know that you're in the United States and doesn't know the person who you're talking to is necessarily in the United States, or on your email, your communications, they don't know where you are when you retrieve your email, or your email may pass through Canada through one of the routing methods. And so I believe that there is a much wider acquisition and collection, but much wider acquisition of purely domestic communications than people realize. And you can see on the other side of that, this massive warehouse, massive data warehouse, many football fields large being built in Utah to have the capacity to store this information that's being acquired under these programmatic warrants, which includes a substantial amount of international and purely foreign communications, but I believe also a substantial amount of domestic communications or communications data at the very least. There are really inadequate checks on that. There is an inadequate regime with any independent check, meaning a judicial check, an individualized judicial check, before your name or your number can be searched in that database. There's no warrant required for that. They say that there are, quote, minimization procedures to protect against the dissemination or the search for data, but you can see from the Edward Snowden revelations a couple of years back how agencies and their contractors, the people who were in those roles, had massive access to those materials and were even doing searches on their former boyfriends or ex-wives and the like. That's part of the revelations that came out under Snowden. And so they say that there are protections in place to protect this information from being seen. The reality is that there are more contractors that have access to this sort of information than probably members of Congress who have a very limited knowledge about what's being seized. I think Mr. Snowden's revelations were tremendously revealing of the amount of surveillance that's happening against United States citizens by our own government on a mass basis. And I think it warrants, regardless of what one thinks about the effort to charge him and what have you, I think that the revelations warrant substantial reforms to protect the vital privacy interests of Americans.
So this has been incredibly helpful. If people want to find out more about you and the work that you're doing, where should they go online?
Sure. Our main website now is exposedbycmd.org, exposedbycmd.org. But you can also search. We have a report up from a couple years back about the amount of surveillance by the Department of Homeland Security domestically and how it was coordinating with businesses, corporations, in that surveillance in the wake of Occupy Wall Street and more, including surveillance of ALEC protesters. So that material is not on our Exposed by CMD site. It's on our PR Watch site. But if you search for the Center for Media and Democracy, you'll be able to find a substantial set of our materials.
Okay, and I'll make sure to put that up on our website and tweet it out to our listeners, too. And are you on Twitter?
I am. I'm the Lisa Graves on Twitter because I didn't think Twitter was going to take hold. I thought, who wants to know what I'm thinking when I'm getting a cup of coffee? I completely did not call that right.
Well, Lisa, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it.
So, Toby, we had a lot of parallels there, not just the Fourth Amendment, right?
Right. When I initially sort of thought about this episode, and it was after talking to my son about the new Amazon Echo, and he was telling me about how it, you know, you have it in your bedroom and you put on an outfit and it will tell you whether you match or I guess you look good or not.
I'm sorry,
you know,
what?
Yeah, it just gives you that feedback. Like,
no.
I don't know.
That's going to fundamentally change, like, female friend relationships. Like, that's how women can, like, I send pictures of myself, like, big job days. Like, I will send a picture of myself to my friend and say, does this match? I'm not okay that technology is going to do that now.
I think it's trying to divide the sisters. Anyway,
sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, and then he said, and then what it'll do is it'll, you know, kind of take note of what you like to wear and then provide suggestions to you of things that you can buy and then make it easy for you to buy that stuff. That was what I was listening to this. I'm like, okay, this is pretty dystopian. And the fact that I'm sure a lot of people will welcome it into their homes, and I'm not saying that's wrong. It's because it's probably extremely helpful in some ways. But to my way of thinking, it was like, what the hell? Like, literally, like, this thing is going to watch what I wear and then, like, say, oh, Banana Republic's got this on sale or whatever. So that was kind of what it got me thinking about this. But then when we actually recorded the segments, it became much more, it seemed, about sort of this, you know, struggle between, you know, individual rights and essentially, you know, the state's desire and right to know as much as it can about you.
Right. And not just the state, corporations, you know, and in, you know, I think in dystopian fiction, there's often one authority that is usurping free will. And I mean, that makes sense for all sorts of reasons of narrative structure and plot simplicity and character development to just have that one kind of specter of the overlord. But I think in our real lives, it's a ton of smaller entities that are offering us something in exchange for our privacy and in exchange for our autonomy. And I mean, there are a lot of things that I have automated in my life through technology, mostly Amazon, because I can and because it makes my life easier. I don't know what that means. Like, I don't know where that leaves us.
So, yeah, and I think it's even, like, even sort of passively, which is that anytime you search for a product that you're interested in, suddenly you start getting ads for it all over the place. So I was looking for a chainsaw, like, a year ago, and suddenly I was reading The Guardian from England, and there was a bunch of Husqvarna chainsaw ads when I was going through the pages. I think it's clear that now there's you put so much data available just through going through your daily life, you know, surfing the web, walking around with the GPS on your phone. I think you, even if you turn it off, you can probably be located. And so these are things that you kind of know are going to happen. And then there's the other things that you're not so aware of and that occasionally you get made aware of, like the fact that your smart TV can listen to you is one of them. So that's one thing. And then the other thing is the fact that things that you may have a suspicion that people can listen to you when you're talking on the phone or read your emails or things like that. And the reality is that they can, and whether they do or not is based on sort of both the law and whether the law is being adhered to.
Right, exactly. And that level of trust that corporations and providers of technology will adhere to the law, like that's a pretty big leap of faith. And it's a big one. It gets back to this idea of what are we willing to give up? And getting rid of technology is not the answer. I mean, it's convenient for me, and I have friends and family members with mobility issues. And for those people, something like Alexa is life-changing. Like, that is incredibly freeing. All of a sudden, they don't have to get up to get something, or they don't have to manipulate tiny little keys on a keyboard if they have issues with small motor skills to find something on Google. And that's really freeing, and that's an amazing use of technology for personal empowerment. But to get to that point, are we as a society also opening up the door for some more sinister uses of technology, and how do we find that balance?
Right. You know, I think the issue in my mind is that I think there's just such a temptation, whether you're, you know, the state or you're a huge corporation that sells like a vast panorama of things. Like, why wouldn't you try and know as much as you can possibly know about everybody? Like, that's got to be the temptation. Once you can collect that kind of information, you know, whether it's used for good or nefarious purposes or just isn't used at all, the fact that it's there, I think, puts you in jeopardy, because even with the best of intentions, you're losing something that until, you know, 30 years ago, the idea of sort of invasion of privacy was like busting into somebody's house or maybe tapping their phone or, you know, searching their car. But now it's so easy to find out so much stuff, and some of it you give up, you know, willingly, like on Facebook. But then other parts of it, you know, if you want to buy something with a credit card, that's out there. So I think that's where you're putting your trust in the restraint of the people who have the ability to gather this information.
Right. And, you know, one of the other things that I found so interesting about my talk with Lisa was how these types of emerging technologies can actually be used in really sneaky ways to reshape our concept of reality. And we talk about this all the time, this idea of dueling sets of facts and alternative versions of the truth, and how the lack of a shared reality is really one of the biggest ingredients towards authoritarianism and, you know, dystopia. And when Lisa was talking about those heavily targeted ads during the last campaign, that, you know, certainly I knew there was ad targeting. There's been ad targeting for several election cycles. It's really hard to track, and it's not necessarily a bad thing. It's out there. It's a tool that campaigns use, but when it gets used to the extent that not even the people consuming it understand that it could be information without context and without a rebuttal, it can become really damaging. And that leaves me with a lot of questions about how we as journalists can ensure good civic decision making.
Yeah, and I don't know how much that is or can be regulated. I think in addition to the fact that you're nailing people with these very targeted ads, I think the ability to, you know, and I think this was the sort of the birth of the idea of fake news, which has now come to include just about anything that you don't agree with.
Right.
But the idea that you put something up that is both, you know, something you made up, but is also confirms sort of the partisan beliefs of one side or the other, and you target it, you put in those people's inboxes or, you know, Facebook feeds or whatever, that can then be taken as the truth with, you know, your confirmation bias, that you're not going to question it too much because it confirms what you've already believed, and that solidifies beliefs based on basically lies and deceit. Again, it seems this is one of those topics that, you know, you start off thinking about talking about one thing, and then
right,
it just can completely morph because there's so many aspects of how sort of ubiquitous technology is now, you know, how much input it's taking from you in addition to you getting what you want out of it.
That's part of why this idea of a technology-enabled dystopia is such a common theme in fiction, too. I mean, it's because there are so many questions about the role that tech plays in our real lives. I mean, there was the book you and Julian talked about. I was thinking, you know, just going back to our very first episode, even A Wrinkle in Time, my all-time favorite young adult dystopian novel, that has some technological overtones. What are some other examples from your reading? And
so, you know, an author who explores those kinds of things is Philip K. Dick, mm-hmm, in different ways. And he's also does some interesting things, like sort of the tension between humans and mechanical things that become human, are so advanced that they're human-like. But for instance, like Minority Report, there is this sort of sense of a combination of technology and using these precogs, these people who can see the future, mm-hmm, to see into the minds of people who may or may not be about to commit a crime.
Yeah. Okay. You know, when I was listening to you and Julian talk, another more recent example that came to mind, there was a sci-fi channel special maybe two summers ago called Ascension. It's worth watching. It's not the Battlestar Galactica reboot, which is probably one of the best things sci-fi has ever done. But it is good. It is entertaining. It's a low commitment. I think it's a, you know, a handful of episodes. And it deals with some really interesting questions around a computer running a small society and reality not being what it seems. So I would definitely recommend that one if some of the themes in this episode are interesting to you. It's also really visually interesting and has a great soundtrack.
I mean, the thing that, especially if you're interested in the in real life aspect of these things, is Citizen Four.
Yeah.
Which was a documentary about Edward Snowden, and
right.
is actually, you know, in the hotel room as he starts to sort of divulge what he's going to be leaking to Glenn Greenwald and Laura Poitras. And in addition to, and they do a very good job of setting up sort of the environment in which he does this, the environment in which the government is able to eavesdrop on you and collect data on you. But it's also interesting from the just sort of human, like, what does it take to try and avoid being scrutinized, isn't the word, being like surveilled
tracked.
By technology? Yeah, by tracked. It's just to see how he acts in this hotel room in Hong Kong and what he feels like he needs to do in order to maintain the privacy he needs for just for personal security.
All right. Well, we are just about out of time. Toby, before we forget, where can people find Julian online?
If you want to follow him on Twitter, it is Julian, J-U-L-I-A-N, in SF, as in San Francisco. So it's all one word, Julian in SF.
Where can people find you online?
At Toby Ball NH.
Excellent. I'm on Twitter at Meg_Heckman. The show is on Twitter at RF Dystopia. You can also send us an email at radiofreedystopia@gmail.com or leave a comment on our website, radiofreedystopia.com. Once again, we are planning an episode for later this month, taking a look at the appeal of young adult dystopian fiction. We have some great guests lined up, and we'd really like to hear from you, and even better, your kids, about novels with dystopian themes that would appeal to teens and young adults. Radio Free Dystopia is a production of Partners in Crime Media. Mike Nothnagel is our News from Dystopia announcer. If you like what you hear, please share a link to our show with your friends and review us on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever else you listen. Until next time, this is Radio Free Dystopia. Partners in Crime Media.